This podcast is recorded on the traditional and unceded territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam peoples.
British Columbia, I've seen your mountains high, seen your pretty rainbows and your blue crystal skies, watched your winding rivers as they flow around the bend. To me, you're not a stranger, you'll always be a friend.
Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is July 29th, 2021, and this is episode 250. Remember when we used to drink Pacific Pilsner during shows in the early days because it was cheap? I'm drinking Lucky Lager. Sorry. I'm drinking Parallel 49 Craft Lager today. We've upgraded. Yeah, we're not in the same room, though.
Yeah, Lucky Lager definitely brings me back to, like, early drinking when everyone just got the cheapest stuff they could find in like a Vancouver Island liquor store. It's not good beer.
I'm from Alberta, so we had Alberta Genuine Draft, and at the University of Alberta, they got a special tap at the bar for University of Alberta Genuine Draft. It wasn't terrible, but it's in the same league as all of this. It's just good cheap beer. Welcome to our 250th episode.
I'm Scott Lundebohm.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, we're not live, as we've done for each of the last 50th episodes. I think we've done four in a row, either live shows at the back of Jaeger's, or last year we tried an online stream one. That didn't work out too great. And so this time, it's also the dead of summer and not a lot's happening. So we've not really planned anything. We do have a series of news pieces to talk about as usual. We'll get into it. But first, thank you to the 103. No, it's 104 now. We had one more patron join. Thank you, Arsh, for becoming our 104th patron. If you want to be cool like Arsh, support the podcast at patreon.com/politicoast. We don't spend your money on beer anymore. We did in some of the early days. We actually have to figure out what we're going to spend your money on. It does help keep the podcast going. It keeps our server costs down and lets us pay all of that, and pays for our fine editor to do their work. But we have a bit of cash in the bank, and so we're going to start thinking about how we can expand the show. It's not enough to do a lot with, so sign up at patreon.com/politicoast.
Politicoast is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners to Politicoast, enter the offer code CITIZEN for access to a special rate. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to politicstoday.news/free-trial.
As it's our 250th, the first thing I want to do is make an announcement of an idea I had. While we were spitballing possibilities for this show, I talked about wanting to dig into who's the best prime minister or premier. Prime minister's been done a lot of times. I don't think anyone's ever done a who's the best premier in BC's history.
Are you sure there isn't a Justin McElroy bracket out there?
I don't think he's done one, so I want to do one, at least with our listeners. There have been 35 premiers in BC. One guy sat twice, so there's technically 36, but 35 different individuals. It's not a perfect number to make a bracket, and a lot of the first premiers, like the first 15, all sat in office for about a year to two, because we didn't have parties for 20 to 30 years of this province's history. And it turns out political parties are a really important thing for political stability. Otherwise, it's just a bunch of self-interested MLAs stabbing each other in the back constantly. What I'm really interested in doing with this, though, is exploring some of the more fascinating bits of BC history. Hey, maybe the winner will be the guy that seized submarines for the province of BC to protect us from the Germans, because in one of the world wars, I won't tell you which yet, there was a threat of Germans coming to invade British Columbia.
Kind of taking a long way around, isn't it?
And yeah, and rather than rely on the federal government and our national army and navy to defend us, BC needed to have some submarines. When you look at federal procurement, maybe it's the best option. There have been five premiers to die in office. One of the more quirky premiers developed something that was pretty much Uber Eats, but it was over 100 years ago, and it was designed to give hot food as a delivery service to prospectors in the Klondike Goldfields. That idea failed, but there's a lot of interesting bits in BC political history that I think will be fun to dive into as we build this bracket. So the bracket's not ready yet. I literally only had the idea about 90 minutes ago. So we'll start throwing some ideas around in the patron Slack to figure out how to seed these 35 different individuals, mostly men, but there have been 2 women. We'll get that going. Next week, we'll launch it and we'll do a few votes each week between the shows. We'll tease who the premiers on the ballot are that week, maybe make a case for one or two of them and see where it goes. I have a sense of where the finals are going to be, but maybe we'll learn something interesting about BC's first premier who no one can ever remember the name of. It's not Amor de Cosmos. He was the second. He was the food delivery guy. So look forward to that. Send us your ideas, podcast@politicos.ca. Let's jump into the main news this week. COVID strikes back. Fourth wave. It's a thing.
I was really hoping we'd manage to outrun this one and get everyone vaccinated in time. But that doesn't seem to be happening. As today we ticked over 200 cases province-wide. And I think it was yesterday, day before, new restrictions were put in place, at least for part of the province, specifically the interior health region where the bulk of the new cases are concentrated.
I think, yeah, it's the central Okanagan sub-region of interior health. So interior health is a fraction of the population size of Vancouver or Fraser, but for the last week, it's been posting about 50% of the daily new cases across the province. And so a lot has been happening there. And we've seen in some of these daily updates, like just today, I think there were over 100 cases in the interior, which I guess are mostly concentrated around Kelowna and Peachland and the Okanagan Valley there, which is bad. It's a lot for what we were supposed to have been past. And it's like frustratingly predictable almost. Like we pushed pretty hard on the restart. Vaccination rates were good, but they weren't uniformly great. And as we've looked at the numbers, there are places where vaccination rates aren't as high. And then you bring in something like the Delta variant, which is more successful at transmitting between people.
It's more infectious generally.
That's a good word for it.
Yes, the typical adjective.
It's been a really long week for me. It's only Thursday, and it's a long weekend, basically off. This will be fun. So it's a bad situation, right? And so we're seeing rising cases there. And we look around the world, and this is what happened. The UK has similar vaccination rates to us and has seen, I think it's a fourth wave for them, but seen a resurgence of COVID despite the vaccination because of this variant and because of too fast reopening and restarting plans.
Yeah, and if anything, we've actually been a little on the lucky side here as far as how Delta could go. Several weeks ago now, I think just before the UK really ramped up, the Netherlands, which is a little ways behind us, but not drastically far behind us on vaccinations. Yeah, they spiked to something like 800 cases plus a day after a much, much lower number over the course of just a couple days. Unlike the other waves, when it's hit the UK and elsewhere in Europe, it's climbed a lot faster than what we've seen with the more gradual increase in kind of waves 2 and 3.
Yeah, and in each time we get this resurgence, this new wave, there's been this like denialism that feels like it's just based on Canadian or BC exceptionalism, where it's like, oh yeah, cases are rising there, but they won't rise here because something is magically different. And it turns out that's not true. And here we are again. And we need to bring in some new restrictions again. Although, as we go through them, they're not great. Like the mask mandate indoors is returned, which is necessary, I think, is a pretty good one. Restaurant maximum capacities have been reduced. Safety plans have to be in place for bars, restaurants, and nightclubs. They can't have dancing. Once again, so dancing has been banned.
We're back to the footloose rules in the interior.
And they're speeding up vaccinations so they can get your second dose in 4 weeks rather than 8. And travel is discouraged once again. We don't see any restrictions on in-home gatherings or gatherings of any kind, which, and I guess there's an effort to shut down businesses faster, which I think is a very good one. It's like a lot of good guidelines.
But yeah, this isn't bringing us back to where we were even in Wave 3, despite being a significantly more impactful variant out there.
And it's one of those situations where, like, the guidelines might have been good a week or two ago, because in each time a wave comes on, you can start to see that slow increase day after day. Like, we were down to 20 cases a day, I think. And
I don't think we ever got quite that low. We were maybe at the very bottom of it. I think we're averaging mid two digits province-wide.
And then it's just like slowly ticked up over the last week or two. And here we are.
Yeah, that's the problem we've seen all throughout. This is a very kind of reactive rather than proactive public health response, where you wait till things start to get significantly worse before trying to hit the brakes. When, like you said, if we'd done this a week earlier or more, it may have actually been more effective. And we're probably, 2 weeks from actually seeing whether or not this will slow things down?
Yeah, hopefully things go in the right direction. I'm still hoping to do some traveling to see family I haven't seen in a long time in mid-August. And we are still seeing cases rise in Vancouver and Fraser Hills. So it's not like it's just a Kelowna thing, as much as it's fun to pretend it's just hippies and retirees in that region partying too much, as it were, spreading the COVID. I will say, like, a week or two ago, I went to Squamish for an overnight trip, and we went to the train museum, and we went into a couple restaurants, and mask adherence had just gone away. This was a week or two after the mandate was gone, so it was just a recommendation. But you'd go into a grocery store and no one was wearing masks anymore, and you got weird looks if you were. And I suspect that was the case for much of the interior.
Yeah, I think it's probably province-wide. Even in Vancouver here, where I think all else being equal, we've probably had a higher adherence to the guidelines. There's been a noticeable in mask usage over the last 3 weeks. Like, just on trans, I've noticed from pretty much everybody being masked up to now, it's, I don't know, like 70 to 80% in that range. That's definitely on a downward trend. Same thing in grocery stores.
I'll give full credit to Science World, where we went this morning, that is still enforcing a mask requirement for everyone over, I think it was 6 years of age, maybe 12. It was good to see. Fun place. Everyone should go. Meanwhile, the main thing the province continues to focus on is the vaccination campaign. Numbers are still doing well on getting doses into arms, but we're really slowing down on first doses. We've broken 80% of eligible people, which is great to see, but how do we get the last 20% of people? Even if we can only get the last 10 to 15, would still be great.
Yeah, we've been very slowly, every couple of days, adding an extra kind of 0.1% onto that 80% first dose number, which is disconcerting to see it slow down on that. And a much higher share of the doses going out now are second doses, which in some ways is definitely good, but it would be nice if we kept up the first dose regime pushing as hard as it was up until we hit 90 or 100 or 95 or 100%. So yeah, the province has decided that it needs to be a little more proactive on things and put out a new campaign called Vats for BC, which they've also been running with the tagline, "Let's get vatsed to the mats," which very much feels like a hello fellow children moment.
If you were woke, Scott, you'd know vaccines are lit.
Ugh, the whole thing has a very cringe feeling to it. It's good they're out promoting it, but there is definitely a boomer parents trying to be cool, or I mean, Gen X parents trying to be cool, I guess it would be, these days, vibe to it.
I assume they hired some marketing firm to do it, gave some broad guidelines. I'm not going to judge them too much for trying something. It's not Mr. COVID from the Alberta government was like the best thing they've done in the entire response to the pandemic. We'll talk about what Alberta is doing or not doing in a second. Mr. COVID was a terrifying, nightmare-fueling character.
Which I think was the intent.
Yeah. Vax to the max, fine. I put it on my Facebook and remind people to get their vaccine if they haven't. I think it does miss some of the mark in that we haven't really explained or figured out why many people are avoiding getting the vaccine. I think just based on some of the conversations in like my local Facebook community group, a lot of people are still confused about if I got Pfizer, I want to get another Pfizer just in case I travel internationally and they won't let me go with a mixed dose thing. And so there's this like obsession over making sure you get your ideal choice on your second dose.
So there is that to an extent. Some Canadians have reported problems with that going internationally and not necessarily having a mixed dose regime accepted. So that is a problem that is very much in the domain of the federal government and something they absolutely need to be working on, because that will probably feel a little bit of second dose hesitancy.
And I think they are, because I did Google this when people were talking about it. And it was like, which countries are you talking about? And they named one. And I found that, yes, it was an issue for a few people very early on. And then within a week or two, it had been fixed. So like, these are getting fixed, but the myths still perpetuate. And that creates uncertainty and hesitancy about the vaccines. And that's what health officials need to target. That's what the BC government can do.
And I know when I went to get my second dose, they had both the Moderna and Pfizer. I don't know, maybe even the AstraZeneca there. I didn't actually ask on that because I had Moderna. And they just pulled up my health record from when I got my first jab and gave me the matching one. So it's generally not a problem to get those. And from what the nurse told me at the time, that they only were looking at doing a bit of mix and matching when they were pretty low on one of the, I think it was Pfizer that they were actually low on at the time. They were low on one of them for the week and did a bit of mix matching, but since then have basically kept it to be what you got originally.
So encouraging people to get vaccines, that's good. Let's keep the clinics going. Like, we are still seeing 50,000 plus people a day getting a vaccine. We're still seeing 5,000 plus people getting their first dose. A number that's actually been pretty flat for a month. So people are still getting that first dose. It's just at a nice, slow, consistent pace.
We're all getting there. Consistent pace.
Yeah, that would be ideal. The other option for responding to COVID was just unrolled by the Jason Kenney government.
Well, but, sorry, before today. I go on there.
Okay.
So yeah, there's the kind of positive reinforcement coming out of the provincial government with the campaign they've just launched. During the press conference earlier this week, there was a hint, though, that it may not retain just the positive reinforcement aspect forever. And Dr. Henry did say that there may be consequences going forward for the people who haven't been vaccinated. The actual quote: if people choose not to be immunized and you work in healthcare, then you will not be able to work in certain settings without taking additional measures. There will be consequences for that decision. So it's currently focused within the healthcare setting, and I'm not sure if there's anywhere in Canada that's yet required it for healthcare workers and made it mandatory, but I know there are places in the U.S. that are making those decisions. Both Google and Facebook have announced that their employees have to be vaccinated to return to the office. So you are starting to see that outside of Canada, and it does sound like Canada may be, Canada and BC in general, may be following along that path, just a little delayed.
I'll be curious to see how the debate rolls out on that.
I think just generally, it's going to be a lot harder, I think, to avoid getting into those discussions than it was before, particularly as the province looks to enact stricter measures in response to the fourth wave. Like, I think we're coming up on 50% first dose or 50% second dose vaccinated pretty soon if we haven't already crossed there. Still in the 40s, if I recall, but I don't have
it. It depends what metric you're using. So the big thing that's not getting talked about enough, there's not much to talk about, but it's the fact that we still can't vaccinate kids under 12, right? So there's still a large number of people walking around who are ineligible for vaccines, who we've largely dismissed in BC as vectors for transmission. That was the whole schools can reopen because we're pretty sure kids aren't spreading COVID too much. And it seemed like to hold true, but whether that holds true for Delta remains unclear. It might be that Delta is actually spreading pretty quick in kids. Now, it doesn't seem like kids are getting sick and dying, thankfully, at serious rates, but a different variant could, or even if they're not, still spreading is still bad.
Yeah, from my understanding, part of the reason that makes Delta more infectious is that the viral loads in general are higher. So, like, an infection just creates more viruses than other variants would on there. And you know, even if kids don't get particularly symptomatic, if their viral loads go up, they could definitely be more transmissive with that. But circling back to what I was saying on that, as we push those numbers higher on that and still have the virus spread, because the math suggests that you need a very high percentage, as in above 90, of the population vaccinated just to try to get close to herd immunity with the Delta, it is going to be, I think, harder and harder to make the non-pharmaceutical interventions, the restrictions on activities and the like fly with the population. To borrow the Premier's words, that you have a certain segment of the population blowing it for the rest of us on that. In this case, the people who aren't taking the vaccine. And as a result, like, I think you're going to see in the next couple weeks to month or two, the conversation shift a lot more to, okay, how do we make those people get it? And how unpleasant does the government have to, does the government, businesses, etc., have to make it to not be vaccinated before that uptake picks up?
The other option for responding to the pandemic is to just throw in the towel and pretend that it's just going to be like the flu and you're just willing to accept a certain amount of background illness and death, as it seems like the government of Alberta has decided to do. Like, I was outside today, and when I was in line for Science World, I think I heard the person behind me in the queue just say, so Jason Kenney has just decided to let people die now.
Yeah, so this is specifically in response to a decision the Alberta government has made that there's just no quarantine rules anymore. So if you're in Alberta and you get a positive COVID test, you can just go about your life. You shouldn't. You should still isolate, but there is no expectation in Alberta that you do anymore.
And it's not just that. They made a series of changes in the past 24 hours to reduce the efforts. I guess they're not going to report daily cases was one of the big changes. In terms of contact tracing, they will contact people who have COVID, but they will not contact people they've been in close contact with anymore. In other words, I think contact tracing is just done in Alberta.
Which isn't great, but has anywhere in Canada actually done contact tracing?
He's put a lot of effort into it. And
yeah, but from my experience, some people have COVID, and the people at Fraser Health did their best, but it was not a particularly comforting or great experience to be wondering about what was happening in that situation. And they're overworked there. They have a tough go of it, but it was not, you know, where you'd want it to be on that sort of thing. And in my experience, it just hasn't been that effective, or it's not necessarily seems to be working that well. And I haven't seen much evidence out there that they're catching enough people quick enough to really hamper the spread of COVID. And we just have lots of cases and lots of potential contacts. The numbers just make it really hard to do on that.
So getting back to Alberta, this is amid them bragging about being at 75.6% of eligible Albertans having received at least one dose, and 64.3% are fully immunized. BC is actually ahead of both of those by, I think, 4 or 5%. Maybe
we're in the second doses?
Yeah, we are. We were when we've been going up fast on second doses.
Okay,
we're at 80% on first dose. And we're probably in similar on fully immunized just because we focused on getting more. We got more first doses out, and that's where we got to prioritize them. But Alberta's really starting to lag behind in terms of how many people are getting vaccinated. The same is true in Saskatchewan. Like, both of those provinces, BC is around the national average, which is a bit disappointing to see. It'd be nice to be above average, but I'll take average if I have to take something. Alberta's not in a good position. They're seeing cases that are confirmed to have spread from the stampede that was 2 weeks ago, which went ahead for some reason. They're seeing numbers rise. I think they had 300 or 400 the other day, but now they're just not going to tell us how many. And meanwhile,
to have happened in the fourth wave.
They're saying so effective immediately is quarantine for close contacts shifts from mandatory to recommended. Isolation for anyone with COVID symptoms is still required, but as of August 16th, isolation following a positive COVID test will no longer be required, but is strongly recommended. In other words, it's a back-to-work regime. It's just like employers are tired of slacker, sick employees and just want everyone to get on with shit.
It's an outbreak at a business is going to be much more disruptive. It's been taking a week off to not have the COVID anymore.
I will emphasize there's still a focus on high-risk settings, so they will be looking at long-term care homes, acute care facilities, anywhere where risk of death is significantly higher, and it seems like that's where they'll focus all their resources. But it seems like they're moving really fast to try to just put COVID into the same realm as the flu or other seasonal viruses and seasonal illnesses that we have to live against the background of. And eventually we will all get there, hopefully. That is the goal. COVID may never go away, but if we can at least get it to a point where, yeah, you get your annual flu shot and you should stay home when you're sick, that would be great. But Alberta seems to really be rushing it. And the public health officer, Dina Hinshaw, seems to just be taking the government line and saying this is now an individual responsibility thing in the province. Meanwhile, not providing the information and tools necessary for individuals to be responsible.
Yeah, it's hard to know how cautious you need to be if you don't just have a general sense of what the case numbers are like in the area you're in.
Yahoo!
Yeah, so Alberta's a mess. Such a just a boneheaded move that there's no reason to do that at this stage, really. Especially as a new wave is on the upswing. Moving on to our second segment, Constitutional Cluelessness. Earlier this week, first off, the new Governor General, Mary Simons, was officially appointed and has taken office, so congratulations to her. But that was shortly followed up by NDP leader Jagmeet Singh asking the Governor General to just break all the rules and just refuse Trudeau dissolution of Parliament and election if Trudeau requests one.
So this was a weird story. It was reported almost as a leaked letter that he had sent to the Governor General. And I don't know, like, obviously the party probably leaked it, but I don't know why they didn't just press release it. Like, the main thrust of the argument was more than just, we don't want an election. It was highlighting Parliament's working. We're here willing to support the government. We passed a motion in Parliament where the only guy who voted against holding a pandemic election was Derek Sloan. Come on. Even the Liberals said they don't want to hold an election. So it was the argument that, like, you can make just after an election when a first minister, whether a premier or prime minister, goes to the lieutenant governor or governor general and says, I can't make this work. I need to go to an election. And like when Christy Clark did that, she was the governor general here. So let's see if anyone else can test the confidence of the House.
And yeah, so the general, there's not a hard and fast rule on it, but the general principle is generally around 6 months or so, that if it's relatively soon after an election, the governor general can decide to see if there is another party or leader that is capable of forming a government and enjoying the confidence of the House. Absent that relatively narrow time frame, constitutionally, the governor general is supposed to act on the advice of the first minister, which means if Trudeau asks for an election, she is supposed to grant Trudeau an election, and there really isn't room to not do that without sparking a constitutional crisis.
Like, it's unwritten constitution that's based on precedent, and yes, the precedent is that way. I just wanted to make sure that Singh's letter is presented for what it was. It wasn't thin as paper it was written on. There was something there, and there was like an actual attempt to make an argument. Now, what I think is more interesting is why make the argument? Because his team would know that there's no way she would say no to Trudeau if he comes. That's just not how it's going to work, for the reasons you point out. So this is politics, right? Obviously, the Liberals are trying to push into an election. No other party wants to go to an election right now, not even the Conservatives, because they're not doing so great in the polls. They're doing slightly less bad than they were a few weeks ago, but it doesn't look like the election will be anything other than status quo at worst for the Liberals, stunning majority at best. So all incentive is for them to go and pull the trigger. And so each of the parties needs to try to come up with what Andrew Wilkinson almost had at the start of the BC election, and probably had 3 or 4 days of winning this argument of a snap election is bad for the province. It's bad when we're in a pandemic and you can't take your eyes off this. Why are you focusing on your own partisan gain when you could be focusing on governing? And we even saw Trudeau in his response talk about the need to put politics behind him. Like, he just heard all of Horgan's winning lines. Whether you like him or not, they did work in the end, and is just repeating them.
Yeah, although I get that, kind of. But is the governor general the person you're supposed to bring this to? Like, the theory
It doesn't matter. The governor general is serving. So, it's not actually about convincing her. It's about using her as a platform to make a broader argument to the Canadian public.
I agree on that, because who you're sending the message to and how you do it is important. And like, it is just generally, like, I think the perception that this creates is not the leader of the NDP telling the Canadian people why there shouldn't be an election. This comes across as trying to work the ref and trying to score points that way, not by going out there and doing the work of politics and making the case to Canadians. It's trying to get the referee, for a lack of a better term, to make calls in their favor. And it doesn't make Singh look like he's taking a principled stance here. It looks like he's a poor sportsman. And ultimately, I think that doesn't serve to elevate the NDP, but diminishes them.
It worked, though. It got Trudeau's attention. And it got Trudeau to respond. And Trudeau didn't even say in his response, that's not the governor general's decision. He didn't even really argue with the appropriateness. He had to argue on the substance, because Trudeau's kind of caught in his own box. And so Trudeau had to go back and argue, oh, the Conservatives are in my way, and they prevented me from passing all these bills that I don't know how to navigate through Parliament. And Trudeau had the option to not respond. He had the option to send his like House leader or some lower member out to respond to this.
Yeah, it's
quite telling that the Prime Minister decided to respond to this like weird letter.
Yeah, I think that was a misstep on his part. Like, from what I could see, basically every even somewhat respected pundit out there was basically going, no, this isn't how this worked. Why are you even suggesting this when the initial letter came out? This is very easily a thing that you can get some surrogate to hit back on. And I don't think there's any win for it. But by Trudeau responding to it rather than having some other random spokesperson bat it down. Like, all it does is elevate a dumb argument by giving it oxygen. And like, there's no reason he necessarily needed to do that.
It's because he really wants to go to an election and he feels like he needs to somehow justify it to Canadians. And does he doesn't have a good argument there.
Horgan never found quite the right reason to, or never came up with a particularly compelling argument on why he wanted an election when he did. What happened, though, is people stopped caring after a couple of days, which is what happens every time there's a snap election. And all this means is that if Trudeau does a slightly better job of setting the stage now, I don't know, they maybe shave a day off that, if that, that the questions are like 10% less pointed during the first couple days of the campaign. But after 36 or more days, when the actual voting happens, nobody will be thinking about that or remembering that. It's going to be pretty much irrelevant come the actual election day. And just the strategy doesn't make a huge amount of sense here.
So Horgan had at least two things working for him in that election, at least. He was able to put forward a vision and an argument for what he could do in government. Now, it wasn't as transformative as the 2017 campaign, because he was just saying, we're going to do what we were doing, but more, and we'll give you $1,000 if you vote for us. Which, it was crass, it was cheap, you hate to see it, we'll give you a cut check, we're going to buy your votes. You hate to see it, but you also love the payout. He also, on the other hand, had a horribly ineffective opponent in Andrew Wilkinson. Like, it was a cakewalk for him. Sonia Firstenau started to put up a real defense, but she was starting quite far back from the damage I think Andrew Weaver left by not building up the BC Greens in the interim. And so federally, if we look at it, does Justin Trudeau have a strong enough record to run on to be able to say, I need a majority government to do this better? The childcare stuff he's working on is promising and potentially leads to that, but how do you convince people in Alberta and Ontario that re-electing Trudeau when Kenny and Ford seem pretty opposed to it in the short term? And I don't think that Trudeau's opponents are as weak as Wilkinson. O'Toole's not in a great position, but I think Singh and O'Toole have more acumen than Andrew Wilkinson.
Yeah, and I do think O'Toole is going to be able to bounce back a bit once the campaign actually gets underway.
Bounce back implies that he was ever in a stronger position against Trudeau, though.
Well, he wasn't in his weak. The NDP can be a bit of a wild card on this one. The last elections campaign performance wasn't exactly a particularly stunning campaign on the part of the NDP, but I don't know. Surprises happen, and sometimes leaders get better in their second election, but it could also fizzle out as well. Either way, like I think the Liberals are generally in a good enough position that an early election call isn't likely to hurt them, unless there is some big surprise that none of us know about now, by definition. But something unexpected happens during the campaign that kind of shifts everything. And if that doesn't happen, like I think it will generally kind of play out fairly similar to the 2019 election, which ultimately turned out to be a lot of noise about nothing, and it was not a particularly stimulating national conversation in that election.
Oh, but the Greens won't be a factor in this one. Sorry to Annamie, maybe she will somehow turn things around, but at this point it seems like the Greens will not be a factor in this election.
Yeah, I mean, the way things are going, even Elizabeth May may be at risk of losing her seat if the party keeps imploding this badly.
Maybe the Greens will be holding their AGM in the middle of the election, because that was something Annamie Paul speculated that might happen.
This is
democracy. It's very important to Greens.
This is yet another case study in how quote unquote doing politics differently does not mean doing politics better, and almost certainly means doing politics way worse. There's no good that will come out of it for the party of having a convention or AGM in the middle of a campaign on that. And all it's going to do is sap what little momentum they manage to achieve, if they even do that, or somehow add even more momentum going in the wrong direction.
So their AGM is scheduled for August 21st, and it's the Federal Council that has decided to push ahead with that date, according to Enemy Paul, which clears so much up in my head.
But why?
Because she doesn't have the choice in the matter. The Federal Council sets the election or the AGM date, and she can't, like, she can say, I don't want that to happen. But once they've decided it, she's not so petty, it appears, to just be publicly saying they're dumb.
How everything else has gone? That, at this point, I wouldn't even consider that petty. Just more like a factual statement on their political prowess.
Yeah, this is a council that's spending hundreds of thousand dollars in a legal battle with their leader as their cash reserves are at the same range. I think
so. They have about 300. They figure after the legal battle, they'll have at most 300,000 in the bank, and they're expecting to spend at least 100,000 to 200,000 on that. So they're basically going to drain half their treasury in the lead up to a campaign on this bit of inter-party squabbling.
Effort to get her out. So they want to get her out, they want to hold an AGM, and they don't even care if an election's happening. I have seen other reporting that fundraising under Enemy has been better than it was at the end of May's term or in previous quarters recently. That doesn't matter if the money is being burned by your federal council and you just can't do anything. Like, it's pretty clear at this point, they are... the National Council of the Federal Greens want to burn that party to the ground to get Enemy Paul out. And you can, I have political disagreements with her positions, but if I was a member of the Greens, I would, and really disagreed, I'd probably just quit the party rather than burn it down or just be quiet for a while. God, this is gross.
Because here's the thing. She decided to run in an unwinnable riding. And when she doesn't get her seat, she probably ends the election with fewer MPs than the Green Party had at the last election. There's just, like, at that point, you can force a leadership. I don't know what the Greens' exact rules around that are, but you can basically have it where that gives you a pretty solid justification for booting a leader at that point. And it doesn't then spin out of, it's not like this where there isn't even a super clear justification for it. There's the whole thing with her, like, former advisor throwing out some ill-considered statements against the MPs in the party, but that was also months ago. That the guy's not working for the party anymore. If they wanted to, they could move past that, but it's, like, not a particularly compelling reason at this point to continue to fight it out.
The other big pre-election tradition, besides, I guess, self-immolation, actually, that's not really the tradition, that's a new one, but the usual thing you like to see before an election is the wave of appointments to lifetime roles, or I guess these are, when are you a senator until 75?
75. Okay. It's like all the other appointments, pretty much, or the Supreme Court appointments, at the very least.
So Trudeau has named 5 more senators, leaving just 10 vacancies left. I don't know why he didn't just do 15. Maybe the independent committee only had 5 names currently vetted. But David Arnott is going to be the new senator for Saskatchewan. He's a former human rights commissioner. There's 3 new ones from Quebec. Michelle Audette, who is an Indigenous leader and worked on the Missing Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Commission. Mina Djerba, who was born in Cameroon and has seemed to work a lot in tying connections between Canada and Africa. Clément Gignac, no, former Quebec Liberal MNA, an economist. And Karen Sorensen for Alberta, the former mayor of Banff, whose Twitter handle is still Banff Mayor.
Does she get to keep the Twitter handle, or does that go to her successor?
In small towns, it's, I guess, up to however you want to do it. It's probably the kind of situation where someone loses a password eventually, and you have Banff Mayor at Mayor of Banff at Banff Mayor Banff. One. Yeah. And they just go like that as people lose passwords. You can be a mayor of a small town for 30 years. Looks like an interesting good slate. All independents, as usual. Seems like a bunch of people who are typical liberals, but not wearing the red jersey.
Yeah, it'll be like a lot of like all of Trudeau's appointments, pretty much, in that officially independent, but like they're small out liberals. They're in line with the Liberal Party of Canada's general worldview, such as it has one.
And this brings the Senate back to gender parity, I saw on Twitter, so that's nice to see. We don't have that in the House or any legislature, as far as I know, provincially. Correct me if I'm wrong, dear listeners, but at least we can have one legislative body in this country have gender parity.
Not everyone, though, was particularly happy with the Senate appointments, though. Jason Kenney took issue with the appointments process, basically arguing that because Alberta technically holds Senate elections, the Prime Minister should defer to the will of the Alberta people on this one and appoint whoever they select, which is just a non-starter. That's never really happened. I think Harper might have actually done one or two, but generally hasn't happened, and certainly since the Senate reference case should not happen. Speaking of politicians who actually need to know their constitutions.
Nevertheless, there'll still be another Senate election in October. Albertans listening who need someone to vote for can vote for Duncan Kinney, who is running as a joke to mock the whole thing. I don't know if he would actually take his seat if offered it by a future Conservative Prime Minister, but he's just trying to highlight how dumb Alberta politics is. So that he has my endorsement for Senate. And just following up on our final federal political story, a few weeks ago we talked about the back and forth in the House of Commons over whether the government was violating the rights of parliamentarians by not disclosing documents on the firing of the two scientists from the Manitoba research lab. And
well, not just not disclosing, refusing the parliament's official request of the documents.
Yeah, and this led to a contempt finding by MPs, which is quite rare, less rare these days. We seem to be getting more of them in Westminster systems after not having many for centuries. But the Speaker has finally ruled on some related motions and has found that the government did violate parliamentary privilege by not giving these out.
Yeah, that's also the contents of the court filing that the Speaker has made in relation to the lawsuit or the suit brought against him by the Attorney General and the Ministry of Justice over this.
You gotta love the idea of getting elected to serve your country, serve your community, and make the country a better place. You're elected to a party with a majority government. They're like, all right, we need a speaker. Do you like rules and procedures and stuff like that? And you're like, yeah, I like that. And I'll still serve my constituents. And then you're suddenly embroiled in this frankly bizarre battle between the government, of which you are still a party member of, and yourself.
I actually see this bit as going back to tradition on that, considering the reason the speaker gets ceremonially brought up to the chair by two people grabbing a hold of them is because back when the speaker position was first created back at, I don't know what century England it was not a particularly popular position to get oneself into because they had the unpleasant task of reporting to the monarch of the goings-on in Parliament, and not every monarch was particularly pleased with how those went. So, yeah. Tensions between the executive and the speaker are an old facet of the system. That said, though, this is very clearly Parliament's prerogative, and it is very inappropriate what the Liberals are doing on this matter. And if Parliament requests documents, that is very clearly their constitutional prerogative, and PHAC has no business deciding not to follow that. Then moving on to a couple of quick takes to wrap up the show. There's a story in the Globe and Mail earlier that Canada has approved a $74 million brokerage permit for the sale of explosives to Saudi Arabia. This, of course, follows the controversies around the sale of light armored vehicles to the kingdom. Although in this case, this is not Canadian manufactured materials that are being sold, but rather coming out of France. And one of the follow-up pieces of legislation that came out of that prior controversy was a 2018 law that gave Ottawa the ability to regulate the brokerage sale or transfer of weapons between two or more foreign countries when a Canadian is involved in it or a Canadian company is involved in it, which is what is happening here. So French weapons going to Saudi Arabia, that some Canadian is involved with the process, and Ottawa had to issue the permit on that.
It's, I guess, when you explain it like that, less bad than directly selling them light armored vehicles. It still violates the ethical, better foreign policy that I think Justin Trudeau wants to project upon the world, because Saudi Arabia is still not generally a very pleasant country or government, I should say.
Yeah, definitely on human rights grounds. They're not great on that.
Yeah, let's not be approving the sale of explosives and weapons to them.
Yeah, it does kind of raise the slightly interesting question of why they approved it. It's not disclosed here, nor do we even know who the Canadian party involved in this. But yeah, because it is slightly more hands-off. You do have to wonder if the reasoning was something along the lines of the French will sell them anywhere. They just won't have this Canadian company as one of the transacting partners in it. Like France has a pretty robust arms sales program on that, and this is like not even close to the most controversial of their arms sales.
In other foreign policy news that's also in the Globe and Mail, CSIS has been meeting with academics to warn them to be on alert for international espionage. The idea being they met with specific faculties, academics, universities, biopharma labs to really just try to find specific areas where foreign agents might be trying to compromise intellectual property. And what's really bizarre about this is CSIS did an end run around the usual process of having the government talk to the academics. So the spies went straight to the schools and talked to them directly, which I don't like. Like, it feels very heavy-handed, and for the average academic, this seems quite alarmist and likely to infringe on academic freedom and the ability of academics to pursue their own ends when the spy agency, with no clear authority to do this, is going and trying to give helpful guides to academics.
So the article doesn't really say one way or the other whether or not that there was prior authorization on this or anything, just that it was not the typical methods about distributing the information. I could see a situation where public safety, the ministry that CSIS reports to, decides that, you know what, this is important stuff. It's prudent for researchers in this country to understand the security implications of their research and any partnering they do with other organizations that may or may not have ties to potentially hostile foreign governments and other entities that may pose a security threat to Canada. That is all reasonable, and that the decision may be just therefore that we want to have this come straight from the horse's mouth rather than having intermediaries and how games of telephone take and a telephone take. That you know how the game of telephone goes and how quickly messages can be distorted on that. So without knowing more kind of one way or the other on exactly what the decision-making process on that was, I'm not quite ready to say it was necessarily a bad thing there. In general, I do think it's good that the government is paying increasing attention to this. A couple weeks back, they announced some new rules around the funding of research and requirements to conduct security reviews on research that has security implications is, once again, a good decision on the government's part, because we don't want to be in the situation where research that Canadians are paying for gets used in a manner that gets weaponized by countries such as Russia or China.
That's such bullshit, though. That's such bullshit because they applied it to every fucking grant NSERC does.
So, you should have copied the form in the Slack on this. I actually took a look at the form on it. It's like a 1-2-page thing that's like a quick checklist that, like, 90% of research, if you do entomology research, you're just going to check no on all the boxes and... it's not a big deal.
Focus on so much of this is this obsession with intellectual property, which just ties into a deeper problem in our academic situation that we've gotten ourselves in, where we are not trying to pursue fundamental research and really trying to do science for science's sake, but we're trying to take academic research and make it useful for Canadian companies and American companies. Some Chinese companies are trying to get in there and we're like, whoa, now it's a national security threat. Like, this is all bullshit. It really is. Like, China has a massive amount of academic expertise. And yes, they are weaponizing that in their foreign policy to build diplomatic relations. Why are we not doing the same? Why don't we pursue that instead of taking this weird protectionist approach? Like, free trade was supposed to make us better allies with many, but here we're like, oh, China's scary. So let's like start making researchers uncomfortable and try and make everything a bit of a chill on what you can and cannot do.
It's not saying you can't do research with partners in China or elsewhere. All it's saying is that
just the government will be watching you.
All it is saying is that when there is potential security implications, such as AI research, which can absolutely be weaponized, we are increasingly dealing with cybersecurity threats, which AI and related computer technology, communications technology, and the like is a key component of, and it is important that potential research breakthroughs that happen here don't get transferred to the Russian or Chinese militaries, and it is similarly important that your and my tax dollars aren't going to funding research that eventually gets weaponized as well.
You know what? I'd love for my tax dollars to not fund any weaponized research for any country, but that's not how the world works. There's going to be some tie-ins. Our academic universities have a protected status. Like, it's not constitutional, but academic freedom is such a core principle that the government needs to keep its nose out of that realm. We can apply it to corporate research, fine.
The form and the stuff they were requiring to be disclosed to the government, it is specifically on funding research. So that this is not just, oh, the universities are doing stuff. This is the Canadian government is...
All research in Canada gets funded by the federal government to some extent.
Yeah, so there's a general government interest in it. This isn't just them going into any old random university and deciding what can and can't be researched there. It is...
But it effectively is. If all research is funded by the government, if you don't get a government grant, you're not doing research. We could spend a long time arguing about this. You like it, I don't. I think the government does need to keep its nose out of universities. You're worried about China. But what about the online space?
Yeah, so I wanted to quickly flag this. Leaf came out earlier today. I haven't had a chance to dig into it yet, but the government has, as part of their new online content rules, started their consultation process on that. In theory, this will be coming out in legislation later on this year, next year, and they're asking for written submissions on it. So we'll throw a link in the show notes if you have any suggestions, thoughts, or inputs on this. You can let the government know.
Yeah, this is basically they're framing it as the supplement to Bill C-36, which was the hate legislation that would add hate speech back to the Human Rights Act and redefine hate speech in the criminal code a little bit. This new consultation looks at how do we make the internet less hateful. It's a big question, and a lot of people have been calling for action because it is pretty much a cesspool out there. I've not seen anyone come up with a good answer on how to balance free expression, protection of marginalized voices, because often new regulations just privilege the most established players.
Yeah, there's definitely civil liberty implications of this too. And it is really easy to be against hate, but when it actually comes to how does that get translated into policy, it is a very murky question that it does not lend itself to easy answers.
Yeah, and it's very easy to have a well-meaning bill have counter effects that actually undermine its purpose. Like, you could have a bill that tries to regulate hate, but just morphs it into a different way and doesn't actually deal with the hate. So I'm definitely going to be looking into this. I recommend you do too. The link will be in the show notes if you have good ideas on how to stop the hate.
And that has been Politicoast. Find links to everything we talked about at politicoast.ca. Support the show and get access to our Slack channel at patreon.com/politicoast. Our intro music credit is Beautiful British Columbia by Serge Plotnikoff. Politicoast is a production of Legend Boot Media, and editing services are provided by CHLY 101.7 FM in Nanaimo. Wash your hands and stay home. Thanks for listening.